My name's Paul Mabry, and I'm a retired family medicine doctor. I like to have these conferences at least once a month to open up for any questions that you might have. First, let me say that I eat a zero-carb diet, which means that I eat meat, eggs, cheese, and butter, and I drink water and decaf coffee or tea, and I put spices on my meat. But I don't think that everybody in the world needs to eat that diet to be healthy. I think it's a healthy option, and I am happy to talk about any kind of diet. I am here mainly to talk about health, happiness, and nutrition, and I'll be glad to entertain any question on any of those subjects. I don't really have anything to talk about to start off with. I do have one question that was for the morning session. Is it expected to have a phase of loose stools after switching to zero carb? I've been 20 grams or less, I'm assuming, of carbohydrate for the past 2 years, but it wasn't until I started striving for zero carb these past couple of months that my stools changed. I haven't had a formed stool yet in this time period. I generally only eat once per day at dinner time. The only other thing that changed is I started getting my electrolytes from a liquid mixture called Light Show. I also have always taken one big serving of magnesium every evening in the form of Natural Calm powder. By the way, even with all this, I still get gastrocnemius anterior tibialis cramps. Okay, gastrocnemius is the big muscle in the back of the lower leg, and the anterior tibialis is the muscle in the front, back and forth at night. Should I suspect the recent shift in carb content or the electrolytes? I'm not a big fan of any kind of supplements. First, magnesium is a laxative. Most major laxatives contain magnesium. The two that doctors use are milk of magnesia, which is mainly magnesium, and magnesium citrate, which we give to people who are going to undergo colonoscopy to clean out their guts. So magnesium stimulates gut motility so that you basically get diarrhea. Well, first of all, I don't recommend any kind of supplementation, because if you take too much of one mineral, then that's going to interfere in the gut with the body absorbing other minerals. Many of the receptors that we use to transport minerals across the gut can do several different minerals. And if there's a tremendous amount of one mineral, they're going to get overwhelmed and not get enough of the other mineral when that might be what they need. So I really, except in extreme cases, don't recommend using any kind of a mineral supplementation. Now, magnesium is one of the harder minerals to get in our diets, and there are people who are magnesium deficient. I was taught in medical school to assume that every patient I admitted to the hospital who was an alcoholic was magnesium deficient, because drinking a lot of alcohol seems to wash magnesium out of the body. It is certainly possible to be magnesium deficient, but it would not take that long to replenish all the magnesium. And after that, you're likely to interfere with calcium absorption. It certainly could interfere with zinc and other minerals. And this is just, in my opinion, a problem, because our bodies are so good at absorbing the minerals they need and rejecting the ones they don't. So if you go trying to overwhelm them with other minerals, you're going to risk getting out of balance. Now, this can certainly lead to cramping. There are a lot of things that can cause cramping besides mineral imbalances. Stress can cause the cramps, and certainly overuse can cause the cramps. But I would say that if it were me, first thing I would do is try to get rid of all the supplements, all the vitamin pills, and just eat a healthy diet. And it doesn't have to be zero carb, but I would avoid sugar. I would avoid any kind of product with gluten in it. I would avoid any starchy foods, and I think that things would get better. About stools and zero carb, the stools of people who eat a plant-based diet are full of fiber because the fiber in the plants that they eat does not get digested. It goes out the rectum. So when a person switches to zero carb, they produce about one-third the volume of stool that they were producing before they started zero carb. For me, that means that there's certainly not a bowel movement every day, and the bowel movements are much smaller. But over time, what I find is that the bowel movements on zero carb have gotten more substantial, up to about one half of what I was producing when I was a plant eater. I think that is because my gut bacteria have adapted to my meat diet. I've now done it for well over 900 days. Bulk of stool is usually about 90% bacteria is what makes up your stool. You have thousands of bacteria in your gut, and it can take a while for the balance of those bacteria to shift to ones that like to eat meat. But it will happen. And when this happens, your bowel habits become more regular, and the bacteria are much happier with meat because now the balance of bacteria in your gut are ones that like to digest meat. And so they're going to grow bigger, and you're going to have a little bit more stool output. But my experience and what I've heard from a lot of people who eat zero carb is that they often have a bowel movement that's maybe one-third what they used to have, one-third to one-half, every other day to every third day. Do you have anything that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, so that was me who wrote in about the stools.
Oh, okay, Ann. Yeah, nice to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. That was really helpful. So are you saying, when you say you don't do supplementation, you don't, you've never experienced any kind of keto flu symptoms?
You know, I say I don't do any supplementation. That's with pills. What I do when I fast is I use bouillon cubes.
Oh, right.
And the reason is because when you're fasting and when you're in ketosis, your body loses more salt than it does when you're not. And you seem to need more salt. So I certainly salt my food. I salt the taste. And then I usually, on fasting days, I take one or two cubes of Weiler's bouillon and just put it in a glass of water and drink it. And each cube has about 1 gram of sodium in it. So I guess really I do supplementation. You know, it's a slippery slope, but I don't do it every day. And I don't take extra sodium other than just salting my meat to taste on days when I'm not fasting. But I do find that if I don't do that, especially in the summer, that I can get a kind of a weak feeling. And the bouillon cube just knocks that right out. One or two cups of bouillon, and I'm right back to myself.
Okay. So,
but other than that, I'm just not a big supplements fan. The only supplement that I recommend of any kind is only for people, let's say somebody who lives in northern Michigan, and they can't get out in the sun because most of the year it's just way too cold. And they may need to take vitamin D3 in some form. Now, probably I would think the best way to do that would be in a fish oil like cod liver oil, or they could simply just eat a lot of liver because liver has the vitamin D in it.
Oh.
But they can also take vitamin D pills because that's, you know, a lot of people don't like liver and, you know, it gets old eating liver. I'm not a huge fan of liver myself, but that certainly is an option. And I think that's what native peoples did to supplement their vitamin D, and certainly what the Eskimos in Alaska seem to do.
Okay.
And yeah, but a vitamin D3 is a hugely important vitamin, and the best way to get it is from the sun. I sunbathe.
yeah.
Other than that, the other thing I think is that's dangerous about supplements is people think, well, I paid $125 for this top-of-the-line supplement pill that's got every vitamin, mineral, and trace element that I need. And so I'm doing so good with this that I can slip a little bit on my diet and occasionally have that bowl of ice cream or that brownie or whatever. And it just can be used as an excuse. Not everybody does, but it could be used as an excuse to go off the track.
Right.
And I just don't think that they're necessary. I think it's basically just a waste of money.
Okay. Yeah. My fasting, I don't even know if I would really call it fasting. I just only get hungry for dinner time. Mm-hmm. So during the day, when I'm at work, I'm drinking plain water, and I just feel like I'm getting hyponatremic if I don't have something in the water.
Yeah, I would just have a cup of bouillon if I felt like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds
great. You can put salt in the water. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, it's just salt.
Yeah. Yeah, that's usually what I do when I start to get a headache.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me. You know, sodium is one of those things. Probably we need more sodium than anything else. And meat is not all that high in sodium, so. I do believe in adding that.
Okay.
And my question relates to the liver.
Yes.
Several months, early in the year, in January, it was like January and February, for about 2 to 3 months, I was doing zero carb.
Yes.
And the reason I primarily do zero carb, or at least started, is because my food cravings are so intense that mm-hmm. zero carb seems to be the only thing that I found that just gets rid of them. I mean, they're gone.
Yes.
And I was working with a nutritionist at the time, and he was not real favorable towards the zero carb diet.
Mm-hmm.
He did a blood test, the comprehensive metabolic panel.
Yes.
And one of my liver enzymes, the SGPT
yes.
or ALT,
yes.
Was high.
Yes.
The normal is like 5 to 40, and my result was 58.
Yeah.
And so he was concerned about that, and so I went off of the zero carb at that time.
Yeah.
But then
mm-hmm.
I get the craving, you know, then I'm back into, you know, the cravings and the mood problems, and I'm still eating a very good diet. I mean, it's just vegetables and meat and fats, but even having just that amount of vegetable, I react to it.
Have you rechecked the test?
Well, what I did was I finished working with this nutritionist in May.
Yeah.
And so I was trying to adjust and find vegetables or whatever that I could tolerate, and I couldn't. So in September, I went back on zero carb again.
Mm-hmm.
And I do plan on retesting, but I wanted to wait a month or two before I did that. So I'm just wondering, my question is, have you worked with or heard of people that have liver issues when starting a zero-carb diet?
Well, the answer is no. I've never heard of anybody who had elevated liver enzymes from starting zero-carb. And I've been zero carb now for 2.5 years, and I've been on 7 or 8 different zero carb sites and read what people wrote, and I've never really heard anybody talk about having elevated liver enzymes. I can comment in general on elevated liver enzymes, like the SGPT. as a doctor, I would scan thousands and thousands of comprehensive metabolic panels, and often I would see an elevated ALT or SGPT, as they used to call it. If it was less than 2 times normal, I normally would not do anything about it. Now, I would first suspect that certainly if the person was heavy, that this represented non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. 33% of the population in the United States now qualifies for the diagnosis of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, or NAFLD, and 15% have progressed to the condition steatohepatitis, or actual inflammation of the liver, and that's when the enzymes become really, really high from the fat damage. This is the same thing basically as alcoholic cirrhosis of the liver. Both alcoholic cirrhosis of the liver and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, or steatohepatitis, are diseases caused by fat deposition in the liver. Fructose, 50% of the table sugar that you eat is fructose, are metabolized only in the liver through the same pathway as alcohol, and the liver has great difficulty doing anything with the energy that's produced from that fructose and alcohol but make fat, which in the presence of a high carbohydrate diet is very difficult to export out the liver because the fat cells are already full. So it winds up in the liver, and this leads to the insulin resistance, or is certainly part of what leads to the insulin resistance, that then leads to obesity and diabetes and high blood pressure, and in women, polycystic ovarian disease, and eventually cancer, heart disease, and Alzheimer's. And this is the scourge that's affecting America. Right now, 62% of Americans are either diabetic or pre-diabetic. So the first thing I would want to do is just go ahead and screen for fatty liver disease, and that's simply done by either an ultrasound or a DEXA scan, the same scan that they use to see if women are at risk for hip fracture. They can use the same machine to scan the liver and tell how much fat is in the liver. Usually nowadays they would just do a liver ultrasound to rule out fatty liver. That would be the first thing I would think of, because one-third of Americans have that. So, and that can easily cause your ALT to be elevated. There's two other things that I think should be thought of with a mildly elevated liver function test. The first thing is hemochromatosis. 6% of Americans suffer from hemochromatosis. It's a genetically inherited inability to get rid of excess iron. So these people have increased iron storage, especially in the liver, and this can irritate the liver and lead to elevated liver function tests. The simple screening test for this is a ferritin. So in general, towards the end of my practice, pretty much anybody who had a significantly elevated ALT, I would do a ferritin level to screen for hemochromatosis. And then if that were elevated, I would go ahead and do the genetic marker test and see if they really did have hemochromatosis. If you do suffer from hemochromatosis, it's easily treated by simply donating blood to get rid of your excess iron. So hemochromatosis is certainly something to think about. And the third thing that you have to think about is hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is one of those infections that in two-thirds of people stays for life unless it's treated with antiviral therapy. And the antiviral therapies are really good now at getting rid of it, and it can cause low-grade inflammation of the liver and elevated liver function tests, and it can be a sexually transmitted disease. It's transmitted in the same way as AIDS. I really personally can't imagine how a high meat diet could lead to an elevated liver function test. I can think of no physiologic reason for that to occur. Did that answer your question?
Yes. I did see my doctor mm-hmm. in June mm-hmm. and had her repeat the liver test, and mm-hmm. it was normal.
Again. The other thing is that ALT is not exclusively found in the liver. That if the blood sample was hemolyzed, there is some, I think, in red blood cells, and if the blood sample were what they call hemolyzed, they had trouble drawing it and the red blood cells had popped open, I think that can affect the test sometimes. What I always hear about zero carb is that it's going to ruin your kidneys, not the uh-huh. liver, and from the high protein. Now, of course, I don't recommend high protein. I recommend that people with the metabolic syndrome limit their protein to 1.5 milligrams per kilogram per day. But the answer is that the only studies showing kidney damage from a high protein diet were done in mice who are given extremely high protein diets, and of course mice are vegetarians who are not designed to eat a very high protein diet. The reason I think that most doctors will tell you that a high protein diet is going to damage your kidneys is because they're remembering back to when they were taught how to treat people with kidney failure. And they remember that the first thing they were told is that people with kidney failure can't eat a lot of protein. And the reason that is because protein is made up of amino acids. And amino acids are basically just a modified sugar molecule with an ammonia atom. They call it an amino group. Okay? But it's basically a nitrogen atom with three hydrogens stuck to it. That's ammonia. That's stuck onto the sugar, and that's the amino acid that makes up all of our proteins. So we certainly don't need all of our proteins for building. So most of your proteins actually get sent to the liver, where the liver chops off that ammonia group. So you've got this nitrogen with three hydrogen atoms stuck to it floating around, and it would smell just like the ammonia in your kitchen, in your blood, and the sugar gets converted to glucose and then burned for energy. So the body takes two ammonia atoms and sticks them together. And this compound is called uric acid. Okay. Uric acid is just two ammonia atoms that have been stuck together. If anyone's old enough to remember when babies actually had diapers and there was a diaper bin, the diapers would be soaked with urine, which is mostly uric acid. Okay, that's where urine gets its name, because we excrete our excess uric acid in the urine, and the diapers would be soaked with this uric acid, and there are many bacteria that like to grow in urine, because urine's a good growth media. That's why we can get bladder infections. The bacteria with the urease to break the two ammonia atoms apart will make ammonia in the diapers. Old baby diaper hampers would smell like ammonia. I've talked a lot about the ammonia, but the point I wanted to make was that people with poorly functioning kidneys can't get rid of all that uric acid. So they need to eat a diet that's not going to produce as much uric acid. Otherwise, it'll start building up in the blood in something we call BUN on your comprehensive metabolic profile, and that stands for blood urea nitrogen. So basically that just measures how much uric acid is in the blood. In people with poorly functioning kidneys, that'll start building up, and if it gets too high, first thing you actually get is the hiccups. And when I was working in the intensive care, if a person started hiccuping, we would always quickly check their BUN to make sure they weren't going into kidney failure. Then you can actually go into a coma if it gets way, way, way too high. That's only for people with extreme kidney failure. But the uric acid, our kidneys are designed to excrete uric acid. They don't have any problem with the uric acid that's generated from an all-meat diet. This is proven by the coastal Inuit Indians before they started eating a Western diet, who ate almost exclusively meat. The Maasai warriors, the Siberian reindeer people, they all eat tons of meat, and they have absolutely no problems with their kidneys. If we look at our prehistoric ancestors, there's a movie that I recommend to everybody. It's called The Perfect Diet, and you can stream it on Amazon. You can stream it from YouTube. I'll put a link in the show notes, of course. The movie documents how, before agriculture, the prehistoric humans were top chain predators who ate almost exclusively meat. And the way they know that is by looking at the various isotopes of metals that are in the teeth of these people. And they can actually tell whether they were fish eaters, whether they were elephant eaters, whether they were deer eaters. And they noted that they primarily ate meat. Teeth are pretty accurate, but they actually have bone marrow from several sites 30 to 40,000 years old in Europe, where they found actual bone marrow that they could test for isotopes. And this is much more specific than the teeth and much more reliable. In this movie, they take you into the actual laboratories and you meet the scientists who are doing this work, and they explain it. So we've been meat eaters for a long, long time. That all changed about 14,000 years ago when we discovered agriculture, which allowed us to have a whole lot more people living in a smaller area and allowed us to get enough food without all that hunting, and allowed civilization to develop. But at that same time, as you'll note from the movie, the average height of human dropped 6 inches. We developed all kinds of nutritional deficiency diseases like rickets, iron deficiency. We started having tons and tons of cavities in our teeth. The jawbones of humans no longer grew as well as when we were nurtured on meat, and we began to have ingrown wisdom teeth, because the jaw simply wasn't big enough to hold all the teeth that it used to hold. There's a dentist named Weston Price, and he now has the Weston Price Society. He wrote a book that details all this, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes too. But I've really not heard anybody give a rationale of how eating a high meat diet could damage the liver. Did that answer your question?
That's great. I will retest in a couple months, but I'm suspecting that I will be normal again.
I suspect
so
you'll be normal too.
I think it might have just been. I'm thinking it was just that one test. Always in the past, I've had normal liver.
I went from a vegan diet to a no carb, and I actually have a hard time digesting vegetables. I mean, going from a vegan high vegetable diet to a zero carb really changed bloating and gas and this, that, and the other. But what happened was, I mean, I already have issues with constipation, and things got really much worse and kind of scary for me on the constipation department. So I went back to my other way of eating, but I'm really having a lot of trouble. There's so many things in vegetables that just don't work for me. So mm-hmm. Have you worked with anybody that's ended up, changing to a zero-carb diet that had problems with constipation?
Yes. I have heard that there are problems with constipation when people change. But constipation means so many things to so many people. To some people, not having a bowel movement every day is constipation. To me, that's normal. To some people, it's they have a bowel movement that's so big that it's hard to pass through, and that's constipation.
Okay, I just want to stop you, because that's what happened. I wouldn't have a bowel movement for a number of days, and then, I mean, I hate to be this graphic, but I'm going to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I literally thought I was going to have my sister take me to the emergency.
Yes.
I mean, that's how bad it was. And, you know, so I got really, really scared, and it was extremely painful. And, I mean, it took like, I did pass it, but I'm telling you, it took like 2 hours with me sitting on the toilet, you know, and it was so I really believe that's the way for me to eat. Now, I do have a lot of autoimmune and this, that, and the other. I mean, I do have health issues that I'm dealing with, chronic systemic mold and yeast and fungus issues. So I don't know if that's added to it, but I really do want to do the no carb. I know that it would be just what I need.
Okay. Well, let me address that. That's a common problem. And what that's called is an impaction. An impaction is where the stool kind of builds up at the end of the colon, and it balloons to have a large ball kind of shape thing on the end, so it just doesn't want to pass through. That can be a real problem. I personally think that the biggest cause of that is a high fiber diet in the setting of poor nutrition. And I believe that a vegan diet is poor nutrition. So the walls of the rectum, the terminal 6 inches of the colon, become stretched out because the nutrition has been so bad that they're just not strong enough, and they stretch out and balloon out from all that fiber, and then you get the problem. Now, the secret to beating that is, so you never want to put off a bowel movement when you feel the very first urges, because if you do, then
I'm always on the ready to jump, run onto the toilet.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing that can be done with a zero carb diet, there's less bulk to the stool, especially at first. Now, I have found that over the 6 to 12 months, the bulk does increase as the bacterial flora, or the types of bacteria in your gut, change to be bacteria that are happier eating meat. Then the bulk will increase back. But like I said, it's not uncommon at all to only have a bowel movement every 2 to 3 days at first. The things that you might consider doing also during this transition period is to help things along by eating some extra fat. A lot of times, if you don't eat enough fat in your diet, then the residue will be harder and give you more of these problems. So probably the first thing I would do, and what I do basically anyway, is, for instance, last night I had a New York strip steak, and I had a stick of butter, a quarter pound of butter, that I put on the plate, and with each bite of strip steak, I sliced off a small slice of butter and put it on top of the bite and ate it. And with about an 8-ounce strip steak, I wound up eating the whole quarter pound of butter. So that's the way I get enough fat in my diet. And I pretty much add butter to everything. Very few things that I eat that I don't think taste better with a little butter.
Well, I would agree, but I'm highly allergic to all dairy. So is there another fat that I could add?
Absolutely, absolutely. In that case, the best thing to do is to get fatty meat. There's one meat that I eat. In fact, I'd say at least half of the meat I eat are center-cut beef ribs. And I don't know if you've ever looked at center-cut beef ribs before, but one side of the rib, the concave side, the hollowed inside, is pure fat. And the other side is some of the tenderest meat you've ever eaten. And the simple way to cook beef ribs is, you know, I cut them into individual ribs with a knife, and then I use a spice rub, basically different kinds of peppers and a little onion powder, a little garlic powder, and I rub the ribs, and then I saute them in bacon fat, just maybe 30 seconds, just till they start turning gray, and that's called the searing process. And you don't leave them in very long at all, no more than 30 seconds, 1 minute. And you sear all sides of the rib. And then I put them in a big roaster, and I pour the bacon fat over them that I used to sear them in, and I put the roaster with a lid in the oven, and I put it at 180 degrees, and I cook it for 5 hours. And when that comes out, the ribs are falling off the bone tender. I mean, you can cut them with a fork tender, and you have the fat. And I believe that this is the best way to cook meat. And I base this on a book I read called Catching Fire: How Cooking Made Us Human.
Well, that's a good idea. I need a book that's going to tell me how to cook. That's for sure, yeah. Because I'm not used to cooking meat.
Well, it's a great book. It's written by Richard Wrangham, who is a primatologist. That's somebody who studies apes. He's a professor at Harvard. He traces the history of cooking as far back as I think it's about 120,000 years is the earliest evidence we have for cooking. But he explains how cooking allows us to get more nutrition from our food. And he goes into the difference between cooked and raw diets in detail. But one of the things he points out is that if you cook at temperatures above around 220, then what's going to happen is it's going to denature the proteins in the meat and basically make it tougher. Some of the stuff, like the ligaments that hold the meat to the bone, are already tough. They're supposed to be tough when they're raw. And the cooking basically turns those into a gel, the collagen fibers. That's why cooking works. So the meat comes out, and it's just basically melt in your mouth good if you slow cook it.
So well, that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. And he explains all that in his book. It's a quite fascinating book. And he also has a lot of sociological stuff in there, especially about how in every major culture throughout the world, 90%+ of the cooking is done by women. He has a theory that in our ancient tribal societies of hunter-gatherers, that the women, as they do in hunter-gatherer societies now, stayed home, took care of the children, gathered maybe some roots and berries and nuts, and did the cooking. And the men went out and hunted. Certainly that's changing to some
extent. Well, I also have heard that the men that go out and hunt, or the men that are out, actually live longer because there's healthiness about being out in the environment.
I advocate something called ecotherapy. Ecotherapy is being out in nature and seeing beautiful things. It's been shown that this reduces your cortisol level, which is the stress hormone, and having too much stress hormone is really bad for you. Cortisol does a lot of things that you don't want to have happen. It increases insulin resistance. It makes you hungry. It causes weight gain. It does all kinds of things that are not good. And so many people are so stressed out all the time that they never find a way to get their cortisol down. And it also gives the brain a chance to kind of reset and relax, almost like sleep does. So I'm a big believer in being out in nature. I do a lot of hiking and a lot of camping. I'll put a picture that I took from my recent overnight camping trip to White Sands National Monument on a full moon night on the show notes, so y'all can see that. But
you know what? I just checked my local library, and they have that book, Catching Fire. So I'll.
Yeah, I think it's a fun book. I think you.
Well,
enjoy
it sounds fascinating. Uh-huh. But I think one of the things I have a hard time with is knowing what. I mean, it sounds like the best thing is to get fatty meat, because I had a hard time picturing. Okay, well, what's a lot of fat and not too much protein, what's the good ratio there? But it does sound like, eating the fattier meats. I really like, I do like beef and lamb. And I noticed that a lot of people on the zero carb, they don't eat a lot of poultry.
I personally feel that my definition of fatty meat is that it has 4 grams of protein per ounce or less. So you just simply look on nutritiondata.com, and I'll put a link to that. They'll tell you,
okay,
how many grams of protein there are per ounce, but the things that I find are definitely fatty are mostly sausages or breakfast sausages or link sausages are what I consider in the fatty category. And I think processed meats are very fine. We've been eating processed meats for thousands of years with no major untowarded problems. People talk about the nitrites, but our own body produces nitrites. Many plant foods like spinach are just full of nitrites. For instance, celery. Celery has more nitrite in it than a hot dog. And if you look at the Oscar Mayer nitrite-free bacon, it has no added nitrites, you'll find that it has added celery powder, which is natural nitrites. So I don't believe in people that say processed meat is necessarily bad. The times that I don't buy processed meats are if they add non-meat fillers, like soy protein or oatmeal.
Right, that can be hard. I mean, I don't do any sugar, so but I do like good cuts of beef and lamb.
Well, I think that up to 2% sugar in the processed meat, most of that's eaten by bacteria in the meat. One of the things that I found out when working in the laboratory, I was a registered medical technologist before I was a doctor, and a medical technologist is the person who does all those blood tests like blood counts and comprehensive metabolic profiles. They're the ones who actually take your tube of blood, put some in the machine, and get the readout and look at your urine under the microscope and those sorts of things. So one of the things I found out is that we needed to do the blood tests for sugar fairly quickly. Say somebody said, I did the test 1 hour after they drew the blood and the blood sugar was 80. Somebody came back the next day and wanted me to retest that because they just didn't think that was right. If I were to recheck that tube of blood for glucose, it would be 40. And the reason is because the blood cells that are in there with the tube have enzymes in them that break down glucose and continue to break down glucose even though the blood is out of the body. And the same thing in meat, there are enzymes that keep breaking down the sugar. So that a lot of that sugar that's in that sausage is getting broken down and basically burned by the meat that is in that sausage that is basically still alive. So,
well, that makes sense because it's almost, you read like, I mean, I don't drink kombucha tea or any of those things, but I've heard that, you have to make them with sugar, but the sugar gets eaten by the fermentation and the fermentation and the what's the other word I was going to say? But the process. So I know what you're saying, and that makes sense. Anything other than adding fat to help with the constipation?
I think I would say just eating enough. You might want to eat a little bit more. Maybe you're not quite eating enough. One problem is that if you just eat a very little bit of food, then when a meal is processed, it's going to just be a little ball. In my experience, I've had to disimpact many patients. And often it's made up of basically hundreds of little tiny balls the size of a marble from little bitty meals. So,
That is probably my problem because, I'm concerned about eating too much at a time because then I'm thinking I'll get worse constipation. But I will experiment with eating bigger meals. That makes sense.
I would try bigger meals and not be scared to eat, a bunch of food. Eat till you're full. And the sausages, basically the sugar that's in sausages and hot dogs is put there to maintain the color, to basically keep those meat cells alive until you eat
it.
And most of that's been eaten up by the time you get there. You don't need to worry about something that's 2% sugar. Those foods are quite palatable. It's great meat. Even ribeye steaks are 6 grams of protein per ounce. The other way to look at meat is what percentage of the calories are from fat. Fatty meat, for me, is at least 70% fat calories. The other meat I know of that works really well is pork belly, but I cook pork belly the same way as the ribs. I just cut it into strips, sear it, and I actually cook it right with my ribs. And pork belly is actually 82% fat calories. But, you know, I don't know if you know what pork belly is, but pork belly is basically what bacon is made from. It's just a big slab of meat that's cut off the belly of the pig, their abdominal fat, and it has abdominal muscles in it. And then they just take that and they slice strips off of it for bacon. And I would just slice bigger strips, maybe 1/2 inch thick, and bake them. You can actually get it now at Arby's, I guess. You can get pork belly.
Well, I live in New England. I actually live in Vermont, and we have so many farms, and you know, where you can buy, you know, local every kind of, you know, meat imaginable. But yeah. I actually have to go. I have another commitment. But okay. Thank you for calling in.
This is Mary again.
Hi, Mary. I just wanted
to make a comment. I just wanted to make a comment about when you were talking about fatty food or fatty meat. One thing that I've enjoyed that I believe is pretty fatty and might even meet your requirements is beef tongue.
Oh, yum.
That's very high in fat.
That sounds
great.
So it doesn't look like it is,
but if you query the nutritional data on it, it has a high percentage of fat in it. I just wanted to make that comment because
How do you cook it, or do you buy it? Boil it? Okay.
I just buy it at the store, and then just put it in a big roasting pot.
Yeah.
And cover it about halfway with water, and I cook it on low temperature just so it's simmering for about 2 hours. You could probably do it in, you know, your slow roast in the oven as well. And then I take it out and I cool it and or just let it cool. And you have to take the outer skin off. It's got the tough skin from the tongue. And then I just kind of either cut or peel that away. And then I slice it up and freeze it in, you know, packages. And then whenever I want a meal, I just take out a package. And because it makes quite a bit of meat, and it's not that expensive.
Hey, it sounds like a winner to me. Anybody else have something they want to talk about?
Dr. Mowbray, this is 2120 again.
Okay.
Every time I start to speak to you, somebody else interrupts.
I'm sorry.
Well, it's not your fault. And I know talking about stool is important to a lot of people in the zero-carb community because I belong to a lot of groups, and they talk about it all the time.
Yep.
I don't want to talk about that.
Okay.
I want to talk about supplements.
Okay.
Because I take a lot of supplements, and I'm perfectly willing to give up on them. However, I have found that there are certain things that I don't want to give up on, and, of course, I'm not going to do it until I feel better about it.
That's fine. Yeah, no problem.
I found that taking adequate potassium has really lessened my need and my desire for salt. And I feel like, for me, there's a few things that I will probably continue doing. I do muscle testing periodically. And I'm just going to go through that for all my supplements, and sooner or later I imagine that I will get an indication that I don't need something. And at that point, I'll drop it. But I take magnesium 3-8 and magnesium malate. When I back off even a little bit, I do start getting cramps, and I like not having cramps.
Not having cramps is good.
Yeah, it's much better. So even though they say that magnesium is not the only thing that plays into cramping, when I hear people suffering from cramping and getting up in the middle of the night, it's very difficult not to push my view on them.
Well, it's okay to push your view. You know what I've actually heard people swear by? I've heard at least 10 people swear by this, that they cured their muscle cramps by sleeping with a bar of soap under the sheets, under the covers with them.
Under the foot of the bed, yeah. Well, yeah. Where your feet are. Under the
yeah, where your feet are. You put a cake of soap. And I've had 10 people swear that that worked for them, that I've talked to.
And it's so easy to do and find out. I don't have any cramping, and I'm happy. But what I found out just by accident is that the threonate really relieves anxiety.
Well, good.
I have a little chart that I've published on various groups about the different kinds of magnesium, and that's one of the things that's on that chart. And a lot of other people talked about how the threonate really let up their anxiety attacks, their panic attacks. And I don't have that, but my daughter does. And I thought I would just try it, you know, and this before I make any recommendations to her. And what I noticed is that the agonizing over bills, you know, I'm retired, and so I agonize over bills all the time.
Well, sure.
When I retired, I was making $130,000 a year. Now I'm living on $50,000. So that was a big adjustment.
Absolutely.
And I was taking the threonate, and I suddenly noticed I'm not agonizing about the bills anymore. I mean, I still have the bills.
Yeah. Oh,
so
sure.
I passed it on to my daughter, and no more panic attacks in the middle of the night.
Oh, that's great.
I think
people that want to replenish magnesium, the thing that I've always recommended, I have a scientific study, and I'll put that in the show notes too, that shows that it is possible to absorb magnesium and other minerals through the skin. And I've always recommended that I think that the body will not absorb too much magnesium. I think that it has control over that, and that it will just absorb what it needs through the skin. So I've always recommended that people want to replenish magnesium if they think they're deficient, that once or twice a week they take a hot soaking bath and pour one cup of Epsom salts in the bath. And of course, Epsom salts is just magnesium sulfate. Epsom was actually a mineral hot spring in England, where Epsom salts were discovered. The spring was just particularly rich in the mineral magnesium. So that's where the Epsom salts things come from. But a lot of people swear by Epsom salt baths. You know, it's certainly a reasonable thing to do. That's why I think that it's so good if people have that wonderful opportunity to go swimming regularly in the ocean, because there are so many trace minerals that I believe can be absorbed through the skin, that I feel that swimming in the ocean is a very healthy activity, if no other reason than to absorb those minerals. I hope everybody has a wonderful day. Bye, everybody.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.